It's the Mike Tech Show, show number 379. This show is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Mike Smith. Thank you very much for downloading and subscribing to the show. Please visit the main website at miketechshow.com. You can email me questions for any tech topic that you have a question on, any suggestions for future show topics. My email address is miketechshow@gmail.com. You can leave me a voicemail message. The phone number is 240-949-2450. The wiki, mtswiki.com, is where you can get links to all of the old shows and links and all the show notes. So visit that. A great resource. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MikeTechShow, and also send me a friend request. Facebook.com/MikeTechShow. Want to ask a big favor of everyone. If you have not visited podcastawards.com, please do so while the voting is still open. The Mike Tech Show is listed in two categories, technology and best produced podcast. You can vote every day. So one unique email per day. Please get the vote out. I really appreciate it. Podcastawards.com. Have great show lined up. I want to talk a little bit about just a minute or two on Siri for the iPhone 4S and something that I figured out and was able to do with Twitter. And then I got a big stack of email that I want to get to and finish up. But before we get started, with everyone working on the go, holding an impromptu meeting can be virtually impossible, but not anymore. With GoToMeeting by Citrix, you can host your meeting online from any computer while your attendees join from any computer or on an iPad, and now from an iPhone or an Android mobile device too. So it doesn't matter what device you want to hold your meeting. And for one flat rate per month, you can hold unlimited meetings. You need to check it out if you haven't tested out GoToMeeting. And to do that, go to GoToMeeting.com. Click on the free 30-day trial and then enter the code podcast. So you can get a free 30 days by just going to GoToMeeting.com, click on the try it free button, and enter the code podcast. One of the big additions to the iPhone 4S is a natural language interface called Siri. Now, that app has actually been out for a while, and I actually used that a long time ago on my 3GS for trying to find restaurants and doing things. Now, Apple has taken it and certainly made great enhancements. Out of the box, it does not support Twitter. And if you say tweet, you know, whatever, or message Twitter or whatever you want to do, and you use the word Twitter, Siri will not recognize it. And it says it does not support Twitter. But oh, yes, it does. And here's how you do it. You go log on to your Twitter account and go to settings. And in the mobile section, click on to verify your phone, your cell phone, to have it be able to submit text messages that are posted on your Twitter account. To do this, you go through a short process of verifying your mobile phone. Once you do that, you're given the code 40404, which is the same number for everybody. And if you text that number, it will post your tweet. So go to contacts on your iPhone and create a contact called Twit or something like it, but you cannot call it Twitter. Call it Twit and give it the mobile phone number 40404. Then what you do is activate Siri and say, message Twit, and it will start the message, and then it will say, what message would you like to send? Talk your message in, it will repeat it, and it'll say, would you like to send now? You say yes, and it will send your tweet. I tested this the other day as people seen my Siri test tweet, and so I figured, you know what? That's the first thing I'll discuss on tonight's show. Is anybody that has an iPhone 4S, you can use Siri to tweet, even though Apple says you cannot. Let's get started with some email. And this is from Mark. It is Windows 7 connection issue solved. I just discovered something I thought I would pass along to you and your listeners. I am in the middle of a huge upgrade for one of my clients. They have an office in Michigan with 40 PCs and an office in Illinois with another 30. I am migrating from Windows XP and Office 2003 to Windows 7 Office 2010, Windows Intune, and Office 365. I started the migration for the Michigan office and everything seemed to be going well. The next day, halfway through the day, all the Windows 7 machines started dropping their connections to the server. They all get their IP addresses from the DHCP server on the Server 2003 domain controller. The DC also hosts Exchange 2003 and DNS. The Windows 7 machines communicate with the domain controller to obtain their IP address and will work for about 5 to 10 minutes. Then they are unable to ping the domain controller. They can still ping the gateway, which is a Cisco 5510 firewall, but they lose all connections to the domain controller. Network drives on the server aren't accessible. Exchange isn't accessible. They can't ping the domain controller, but pinging by name does resolve to an IP address. So DNS, which is on the same domain controller, is working. The Windows XP machines that I had not migrated yet remain connected to the domain controller and never dropped the connection. I beat my head against the wall for 2 days trying to solve this issue, and I finally figured out what was going on. It turns out that when you have Windows 7 machines connected to a Cisco 5510 and probably other 5500 series routers, that you have to turn off ARP proxy on the inside LAN interface, and my connection issues all went away. I just thought I would pass this along since the Cisco 5500 series is a popular small business router, and there are many people making the transition to Windows 7 now and in the future. Mark, thank you so much for that warning. These are the kind of tips and the things that you can learn by listening to this show, that something that it drove him crazy and he solved it. And I'm so glad that he took the time to write this and share it, because, I mean, this thing's now logged in my memory. If I ever run into something like this, I'm going to look at the router. It may not be a Cisco router. This could also be for a problem for other routers. So what he did, he turned off the ARP proxy on the inside LAN interface. Keep that in mind for that possible problem. This is from the computer doctor, Dr. Kevin, and I like this, chief of computer medicine. That's awesome. Hey, Mike, this summer has been very busy for us, taking on a handful of new small business clients. A couple of them are startups, and I have been doing it and have been doing it themselves all along and now realize they need help. Several were dumped when their previous IT guy shut his practice. And as always, some customers had a bad breakup with their previous support company. And each IT guy and company has their own way of doing things. Plus, you know that in most cases, the clients have little to no documentation and may have an idea on how things are set up. Oh, this is exactly what how I live with my clients. This got me to thinking. I'm curious to know if you have a specific checklist that you go through when taking on new clients. More specifically, does the discovery process of going through and learning how the machines are all set up? What are the software that they use? How is the network? How the network is set up? Is there a server? If yes, it is a real server. What about backup systems, security, antivirus, and so on? We would like to develop a specific process we go through when working with new clients and going through the discovery process. Any of your professional insight would be quite helpful. Also, as a responsible consultant, I know you make sure you document everything. What is your process for this, and how do you manage sharing this information with the clients? We've just started experimenting with Google Docs since we host with apps for businesses and then share a read-only version of the document with the client. That way, they have access to everything, and should I win the lottery one day and move to Hawaii, they'll all have the information for their next IT guy and company. Thank you. My process is simple. I interview the client, and I've actually, I think I did a show dedicated to this with a checklist, but more importantly, the software that I use is SIW, and I will put a link in the show notes, and I'm actually an affiliate for this. At least I think I am. I've set up. I'll put the link in. Buy the technician's license. It's one fee for lifetime upgrades, and you run this program on every computer. When I have a company and they got 20 computers, I take my USB stick with SIW, and I hit every single computer. Now, along the way, I'm taking notes as I call it my initial assessment. And it's a couple hours that I use for each new client. And they love it because I put a full report together and do an assessment that I turn over to the person that I'm reporting to at the company, making my recommendations. Now, along the way, if we already have a contract in place, as I'm sitting at each computer, I do my Mike Smith tweaking of the systems. I check what's starting up. I stop a lot of junk from starting, clean all the temp folders, take a look at the event logs. What's going on? Are there errors or the things? So I have a little checklist that I'm sure you have when you sit in a new machine. But one of the most important things is generating that HTML report that SIW generates. And I put that on my USB stick. I put that all together as a big attachment, and I send it to my client so they can actually save that information. And in there, I have recommendations because I'll run into computers that they could use more memory. I also run crystal disk info on every system. So along the way, I now know whether the hard drive is good or not. I will say, you know, system A needs a new hard drive. It's starting to go bad. You know, system B, C, and D could each use gig, you know, extra gig of memory and so forth. And now you've got a great assessment. And I do this for the server too. I take all that information, I bring it back. And now I start analyzing it. In the chat, they mentioned Bellark Advisor. Once you use SIW, you'll never go to Bellark Advisor again. SIW is the most complete information that you would ever get. Now, Reliant just said, what about Citi? Now, Citi is interesting. Interesting. I talked about that. You get great information on the report, but it is not as complete as SIW. It's great, and I've done a show on Citi, and that's spelled S-Y-D-I. If you Google Citi Project, great program, and you can sit back and actually launch it to generate reports on lots of systems. I'll tell you where I use that. where it's not practical to visit every computer, where maybe there's several hundred computers and you need to get a report on each one, you can just set up City to just run. It's a bunch of scripts and they can be run remotely. You could just launch it and it will go out and it will run remotely on all the computers that are on the domain, and it will come back and generate a great file that you can then put together as a, it's a Word document. It also generates files for all the software that's on the machines that you can collect and gather a consolidated report in Excel. There's lots and lots of great programs out there. My opinion, I just love SIW, and just because it gives me the best information, and that's why I like it. Bellark's good, but it doesn't give you as complete as SIW. There's a big difference when you take a look at the reports. Then I sit down with the client after I submit this analysis so we can discuss what are the priorities that we want to attack. What's, you know, what do we want to do first? What do we want to do second? And the first thing I always discuss is the server. If there is a physical server on site, and is it a real server, as you said, or is it really just a peer system? I will go over that. It'll tell me all the updates. Here's the big thing. As I'm evaluating all the computers, I'm also evaluating their backup procedures, and especially the server. I check what software are they using? What antivirus software are they using? Do they need to be upgraded? Is it centrally managed? Or is it just one-off installed? Or is it a hodgepodge? Whatever flavor of the day that was installed on the computer. That's what I normally see. And I try to get everything centralized, and if they have a server, I create an MHS consulting directory. That's the name of my company. I put that on the server, and I now put all of that information in that directory. And there's also a change control file. It's a text file, very easy, that anytime I'm making a change to the server, it is listed in there, the date and what I did. That information is shared with the owner or whoever I report to in that new company. And then that's how that information shared. And I am completely open. And anytime I'm evaluating anything with a client, I make sure they have everything I have. If I have information, I make sure they have it and it's available. This is from Bruce. And he says, it's a mouse explorer problem in the subject. Mike, I recently got a problem with my desktop PC, Windows 7 64-bit. When the mouse right-clicks within Windows Explorer, which brings up a list of actions, but it will often crash Explorer, and then Explorer comes back by itself. I have read web comments and tried some corrective action to no avail. Is there a real fix for this phenomenon that you may have heard of? Now, just by right-clicking within Windows Explorer and you're crashing, first, are you truly spyware clean? Is the computer absolutely cleaned from any infections? You got to run your standard super anti-spyware, Malwarebytes. I want you to run CombiFix. Once we know the computer's clean, are you getting any errors in the event logs? Are the event logs clean? Run a memory test. Check the hard drive, which is by using Crystal Disk Info. Run your hardware diags from HP or Dell. And remember, Dell, you can activate that by hitting F10 and then run the diags. And it gives you a quick feedback. Here's the video card, the CPU, the memory. You get some tests. They're not the best tests in the world, but it gets you a little bit, is the hardware running fine? So if we've certified that the hardware is good and there's no viruses, and the hard drive's good, boy, the only thing left is get your data off there and you may have to redo your system. Hit each of them, so start with the basics, because there's not enough information here to really give you a specific fix. So I'm throwing everything at it. But the kitchen sink. Try all these things, Bruce, and then get back to me and let me know if any of them discovered something that fixed the problem, or did you have to do a complete redo? This is from Peter, and he wants me to take a look at this. It's a Skype exploit. It's a link from Network World, and it's a Skype exploit, a security problem within Skype. And interesting that every week when I open up Skype to do a show with Carrie for my Tech Vet show, Carrie Holzman, it's the only time I really open up Skype other than voicemails coming in for the Mike Tech show. And there's an update. There was times where I did an update and then there was another update. So clearly Skype is constantly improving and doing the updates that's necessary. Even if there is a problem with Skype, I would think they're going to be pretty fast to do the upgrade, do an update to patch the hole. So what I would like you to do is make sure that you are updating to the latest and greatest when you're running Skype. An Exchange 2010 question. And this is from Carlos. Hi, Mike. Big fan of your show. I like the professional approach which you conduct your program. Always right to the point, never going off subject, and always with useful information. My work has recently migrated to Exchange 2010 from Exchange 2003. We worked with a consultant on the whole migration, and I work on the everyday desktop and minor server support here at my job. As you know, many things have changed between the Exchange versions, and my question is, what is the best way to change one's user's ability to send and receive larger emails? By default, Exchange 2010 allows you to email up to 10 megs. I want to change this to 20 on just one user. I don't want to change the settings for the whole organization. Any help will be appreciated. Thanks. You can do this on the mailbox itself. The checkbox, you just take off the information store default, uncheck that, and you can set whatever limit you want on the mailbox or no limit at all. You do this at the individual user's mailbox on the server and just uncheck for following the default storage limit. Now, advice for sending and receiving over 10 megs. I have a client, a law firm, that consistently tries to send such big attachments that they've scanned that are so overwhelming, it cripples their system and their Outlook is just ready to explode. And it happened again today. And it happens all the time. And I've tried to tell them, now they don't have an Exchange server, so they're using Google Apps to send their messages. Do not send huge attachments because you don't know what the limit is of the recipient, most likely, and their email system, and there could be limits. I have a rule of thumb. I keep everything under 10 megs. Anything greater than that, find another means. Use FTP. You send it. There's a lot of free services out there that will enable you to send large files, and it sends an email to the recipient that they can then begin to download very easily. So you do have services and you do have FTP. That gets a little more complicated, but that's just my rule of thumb. So you may want to educate the user that wants this limit raised. Sometimes, you know, you have to be the watchdog and the guard and the bearer of bad news, and you got to educate them. You know, just because they want it doesn't mean they should have it. And you want to coach them with this advice saying, you know, just because, you know, I give you 20 meg, you may not be able to get them to the person you're sending it to. So keep that in mind. This is from Pekka from Sweden. And he says, in show 377, there was a question for a self-extracting software for notes. I think that fsecret, S-E-K-R-I-T, so F-S-E-K-R-I-T, can be a solution. And he has a link, and I will have that in the show notes. Thank you very much. This is from Nancy Jones, longtime listener. She says, wow, I just got a bizarre phone call from a technical support service. The caller had a heavy Indian accent. He said he was calling registered Windows users so they could be aware of non-secure software running on their computers. He couldn't explain how he got my name or number, and he had me go into Event Viewer and tried to scare me into thinking that all of the warnings, all five of them, meant that I had non-secure software running. I could identify all the events we were looking at, and he got frustrated pretty quickly because he couldn't get me to buy into his scare tactic. She lists the phone number here, but calling back doesn't let the call go through. I can't put a block on this number, but I saved it as a contact called phone scam. So plug this into your phone book and label it phone scam, and when it calls, have some fun with him. Oh, I so want one of these calls so I can record it, and I will play with him, and I will post that. By the time I told him I was a system administrator, he figured out he wasn't going to get anywhere, and he may have been quasi-legitimate. I doubt that, but it's not very good business model. I expected him to hang up long before he did. Nancy, thank you, and I've talked about this a couple times, and Kate actually brought this to my attention. It's happening more outside of the U.S. than it is in the U.S. Definitely want to get the word out to our non-techie friends and listeners and acquaintances that if that ever happens, don't fall for it. There's no way anybody should be calling you and having you go to your system and do anything. It is a scam that they'll get you to run something or go to a website, and it's all about getting your credit card. So we don't want that to happen. And I know anybody listening to this show, that wouldn't happen to you. But if you do have the opportunity to easily record that and you do play with them, that would be very cool, and share that with me. And I absolutely will play that and post it up. This is from Michael. I enjoyed your last show. You commented on iOS 5, which made me think whether you use an Android phone at all. No, I don't. We have made a new application which enables you to write, send, and receive your text SMSs on the computer via your Android phone. Generally speaking, like giving your Android a keyboard. And he actually gives me a code here. It is not a new thing, connecting your phone with the computer, but the way and experience is new. These new apps are quite popular because you do not need to take out your phone or the hassle of the touchscreen. I hope you will enjoy it. And this is from Michael. Michael, I appreciate that. And one of the things I don't have exposure to is an Android and an Android phone. It almost makes me want to pick an inexpensive tablet that's generic enough with the Android OS just to play with it for the experience. Or what I might need to do is, can I get the development OS to maybe run in a virtual environment that I can play with Android on the PC, like in some kind of a test mode for that they do for app development. I listened to the announcement of the ice cream sandwich OS that they released the other night. I think that was on the Galaxy phone, and that was at 10 o'clock p.m. Eastern time from Hong Kong, which was 10 a.m., and I thought that was pretty cool, and it was very, very good to hear that, get an idea of what was happening with the Android. I ran into Biker Boy 80 in the chat. I was at his house working on his home network, and he has an Android phone with an iPad and then a Windows system. Does have a Mac, does use iTunes, so he's part Mac, part Apple, part Windows, part Android. So Now, how do you get this all to work? And the Android was interesting. I could offer no assistance. So it's something that I'm working on to gain more experience with the Android. And if you have ideas of how I can inexpensively, easily add an Android into my environment, I would like that, just to be able to give feedback and to be able to have some experience. So when I run into that situation with a client, I can give sound advice and advice when integrating everything. It's the one piece that's missing from my repertoire of experience, and I just don't have any on Android. This is from John. Two items. Can you do a show on thin client computing? I have a major building project at a company that uses the thin client computing. Part of the project is providing additional thin clients. A high-level description would be helpful. And then, who is the artist that is playing the song at the beginning, and it's also at the end of my show, and that is Rob Costlow. And you can find him on Magnitunes, which is at the link of every one of my shows. And Rob Costlow is that tremendous, gifted pianist who I take a piece of the song Reflections for my intro and my outro. And I have the permission from the author, from Rob, who's just a great guy. One of the coolest things that Barb, Citizen X in the chat, did for me a couple years ago as a birthday present, put together just one of a beautiful collection of birthday wishes to me. And she reached out to Rob Costlow, and he actually played Happy Birthday to me. And I think he played it to Barb's answering machine, which she then saved and put into the MP3, and that was just so cool. So anyway, I just figured I would add that story. Oh, the Citrix. Thin client computing. I'll tell you, that is so specific and so kind of out there that, and I guess vertical for, you know, such a small population of listeners that would want that. It almost warrants a special show that would be perfect for a Saturday. And let me reach out to some thin client experts that I know that are maybe previously worked for me in the past, because we had a very large thin client deployment. So let me see if I can coax one of my engineers to come on a show on a Saturday, and we beat up client computing. Final email of the night from Norbert Davis, and he asked me, did I ever answer the email question about needing to have a person add it to the blind copy, the BCC field, but only on certain occasions? Here is something that, while not close, might inspire someone with better skills than I. And he gives me a great link. And then he has another helpful link. So two more links on how to solve that problem, which I've had some great feedback for that from my client. And there is one that I am actually going to be testing when I remote in, that I'm going to build that HTML shortcut that is going to, he'll be able to click, that will open up the message and populate the fields the way we want. That was sent in, I believe, by Paul from San Antone as a great solution. And so now we have a couple more. And these are great things to look at, that even though you don't have the problem, you may run into it, or it may spark a solution to something else that you're working on, especially within Outlook. If you purchase anything from Amazon, or know anyone, any family member, friend, neighbor, anybody, send them to my links. And it's very easy to remember. It's amazon.micnation.net or miketechshow.com/Amazon. Or you can just send them to my website, and there's a big link on the left-hand side. Click on that, go to that link. Anybody that uses that and purchases anything, it doesn't have to be electronics, I will get a commission, and it helps support the show. And I really appreciate everybody's support and your feedback, your email, your voicemails. It's been great. No music for the end of tonight's show. That's it. I will see you, talk to you next week, same time, same channel. Bye-bye, everybody.
You've been listening to The Mike Tech Show, a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. Please visit techpodcast.com.